Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Neil McGregor, the director of the museum, and it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome you to the Guardian British Museum debate about Nigeria, Africa's superpower. As you all know, we have on at the moment the great exhibition of the sculptures from West Africa, the Kingdom of Ife. It's been a huge critical success, hailed as the exhibition of a lifetime by the critics. And it's part of a long program we're putting on this year at the museum to focus on aspects of African culture. You'll notice that there's another aspect outside in the garden from South Africa, which we've done jointly with the Botanical Gardens in Kew, raising issues about the plant life and the sustainability of the environments of Southern Africa. But you'll also notice that we put on the exhibition of sculptures from Ife at the same time as the exhibition of Italian Renaissance drawings, because we wanted to make the point that nobody, when they learn European art history, studying Italy and the Renaissance in the 14th, 15th centuries, is taught that at exactly the same time in West Africa, artistic production of the same level and the same quality is going on. We learn our art histories in separate chunks, we learn our histories in separate chapters. And putting the two together, we wanted to make the point that this exhibition is not just about Nigerian culture, but about the relationship between Nigerian culture and the rest of the world. As many of you will know who've seen the exhibition, when the Ife sculptures were first seen in Europe, they caused a sensation. Because of the quiet restraint, the close physical observation, and the technical skill from a culture that people didn't know and for which there were no written records. And that, of course, is why this kind of exhibition is so important, because in the absence of written records, the documents for the history of Ife and for this moment of Nigerian culture are, of course, the things, these wonderful things that are still being explored and still revealing very important information. The quality of the objects continues to astound, and particularly the objects that have never been seen before, like this wonderful seated figure from Tada made of copper. The formidable difficulty of making a figure of this scale out of copper is why this is one of the most important objects cast in metal before the modern era anywhere in the world. And you can all see, I think, the extraordinary skill with which the sculptor has observed a sitting figure, observed the way the weight shifts, the weight moves between the between the different parts of the body, and rendered that in the bronze. On any view, this is a masterpiece, not just of observation, but of sculpting and casting. The objects themselves are still very, very mysterious. We know a great deal more about them than we did, as you've seen upstairs, but as I think you'll also have seen, we're still learning more and still having to guess about exactly what, for instance, the striations on the face actually mean or represent, what we can actually tell about the society of which this man, this must be a portrait of a man, was a ruler, what role he played. And we can, of course, observe the same meticulous creative skill in the statues of the women, and also raising the same questions. What were these sculptures for? Why were they made? How did they fit into a world of power, of court ceremony, of ritual, of belief? And we have some clues through surviving practice, through legend, through observation. But this is a history that is still very much in the making. And it's not, of course, just the history of Ife. The bronze-casting world of West Africa is an astonishingly large and rich one. Large parts of the Niger Basin are involved. And, of course, it's from Ife that the rest develops, and particularly Benin, which is, of course, much more known to Europeans. This beautiful little statue of a royal messenger is evidence of the links between Ife and Benin. We know that when the king of Benin was being installed, he would send to Ife, and the ruler of Ife, the Oni, would send back a cross and a staff as emblems that the Benin king was actually legitimately ruling. And these were the sculptures, of course, that first startled Europeans when they came after the shocking circumstances of the Benin raid of 1898. It was these bronzes that forced Europe to rethink its attitudes to Africa. It's hard to exaggerate the extent to which these things changed the way Europeans thought. The whole of the history of Africa had, for Europeans, had to be reimagined in the light of a society that could produce works of art of this quality, previously unknown. And what's interesting about this object, since where the last one I want to show, is because this, of course, is later, it's about 1500, 1600, when there's regular contact between Western Europe and Benin. And the sculpture, the carvings are made with the bronze bracelets. You see the little figure at the top right is holding a bronze bracelet. The raw materials exported from Europe to be turned into the high art in Africa. But it also shows a moment where the Oba, the king of Benin in the middle with his courtiers, is in complete control of the relationship with Europe. The two European figures are those little figures with silly hats at the top. This is a relationship of equality between Europe and West Africa. And at the same moment, we know that in Kilwa, in modern Tanzania, there's a major port all up the Swahili coast. There are ports trading, again, on equal terms with India, with the Gulf, and with China. Around this period, the relationship between Africa and the rest of the world is one of equality, one of exchange, and one of mutual respect. We all know, of course, that that did collapse, and we know why that collapsed. But the interesting question, I think, tonight, looking at the exhibition, these extraordinary achievements, which we've been so privileged to be able to borrow from Nigeria, looking at those achievements, to ask the question of how now the relationship between Nigeria and the rest of the world should be imagined, constructed, how it can become what it should become, and which it was at the moment that these sculptures were made. And nobody could be better able to lead that debate and that discussion than John Snow, who has, as some of you have seen, bounded into the auditorium a minute ago, having bicycled straight from the news. So, John, thank you very
much. Pity you ended on your only exaggeration, Neil. Neil McGregor, thank you very much. Well, welcome. I just have to quickly tell you a couple of things. Could you possibly turn your mobile phones off altogether, because the vibrate even cuts across the recording we're making. We're going to podcast this. It'll be on the Guardian website, to whom enormous thanks for sponsoring tonight. And it will also be on the British Museum website. Please identify yourselves when you speak and speak into the microphone when it comes. And the debate is already begun on Comment is Free, following articles last week by Chika Unigwe and Abdulrafu Mustafa. So there's plenty there to engage with. So let's begin at the beginning. The exhibition is a complete sensation, and to any layperson, as I would certainly confess myself to be, having only been to Nigeria three or four times, it's a revelation. It stands history on its head. Father Matthew Kuka, give us a bit of background and bring us up to speed. Yes, I think it'll take you automatically. All right.
Thank you very much, John. I feel like some slave who has suddenly discovered is a prince. it's very difficult to convey my personal emotions. So let me first of all thank the British Museum. I think this is coming at a very, very special time for us in Nigeria. It really is a question of what we make of that. But I think what is very interesting about this event and, you know, the exhibition itself is that perhaps we need to take it along with other events that may have been taking place, you know, in the larger areas of what is now modern Nigeria. You know, in what is now Borno State, for example, that is the Dofuna canoe, which was discovered and it's been dated to have been about 6,000 years old. When we think about the history of the Sokoto Caliphate, for example, or the Nok culture in what is today the modern Kaduna State, which is said to have been 1,000 years before Christ and literally vanished 200 AD. I think when we take all these things together, perhaps the critical question is, how do we make this knowledge available to ordinary Nigerians? Because a lot of the literature on slavery, for example, has tended to convey the impression that somehow we were children of a lesser god and we just didn't have the capacity to resist, which is how we ended up where we have ended up. And a lot of this formed the bedrock for racism and so on. I think it's not so much a question of going down the path of the talk about colonialism and so on and so forth, but I think the director of the museum has made the point eloquently. It only remains for us to ask ourselves, knowing what we know now about our country, and I think even for a lot of us in the audience, this is limited knowledge. I think the first challenge that I will pose is, I prayerfully hope that somehow this information will become available to Nigerians and I will begin to think a bit more clearly and much more creatively. This is the 50th anniversary of the history of the independence of our country. We are at a very, very important moment in the history of our nation. And let me say, like somebody said recently, it's for the first time the 1958 Willing Commission preceding Nigeria's independence was meant to take a look at the sentiments expressed by minorities in the middle belt of Nigeria and in the south of Nigeria. There were agitations that ordinary citizens belonging to the other ethnic groups outside the three dominant ethnic groups didn't feel that they were part of the Nigerian project. And that has been the history of our country for the last 50 years. But as we are speaking, the president of Nigeria happens to be a minority from the Niger Delta. The Senate president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, who is, if I may use the expression, the second most powerful citizen in the country, is a minority from Benue State. The Chief Justice of Nigeria is also a minority from Benue State. So at least even this reversal of roles strategically places the conversation at a slightly different level. So I think if we go back to the words of good old Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, the wind of change is actually blowing, but in a far more dramatic way. So I think that the challenges that lie before us will be whether we'll develop the capacity to really take on and strategically place Nigeria in a position in which it can serve the interests and purpose it was meant to serve, in part because we have the human resources, and I think we are on the right way. We've had a history of terrible elections. We've had a history of military rule. But I think we have turned the corner. One, because we are on the path of democracy with all its flaws and contradictions. I believe that once we continue on this road, I think we can take off from where this exhibition has just left off.
Father, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Raufu, you would argue, I think, that Nigeria in the region is much more powerful, perhaps, than Nigeria as Nigeria inside itself, in a funny sort of way. That it's into peacekeeping, it's into all sorts of extraordinary performance across the continent. Set the context for tonight's discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. I do share the sentiments of Father Kuka that there's quite a lot in the country, in Nigeria. But as somebody who came of age in Nigeria in the 60s and 70s, personally, I think that Nigeria hasn't realized the potential, the hopes that people like me thought would be the fate of the country at this point in time. And I don't think it's just an issue of my own personal. Many Nigerians feel the same way, many communities also, Al Hazard, feel the same way. In many respects, Nigeria is a country with tremendous potentials, historical, contemporary, but potentials that have not been fully realized. It's in a sense a land of unrealized dreams, as it were. And I think that problem of always seeing our future as a something there at the end of the horizon to capture, but never quite getting there, has to do, I believe, with failure of leadership, failure of vision, and failure of institutions. The leadership, the institutions have not been able to capture the energies of Nigerian peoples and communities and to channel this in constructive ways. So in many respects, therefore, the Nigerian state hasn't met its potential. And worse still, in some regards, it's a state at war with its citizens. If you look at the figures, survey figures, coming from something like Afrobarometer, looking at the attitude of the citizens and the delivery, response to those attitudes by the institutions of the state, the Nigerian state is basically ignoring the basic sentiments of its people. And it's hardly surprising that many of them have taken all manner of antisocial and dysfunctional ways of expressing their disenchantment with the system. But what is equally important is that the Nigerian state has not collapsed. We may gloss over that partly because we don't really look carefully at the African scenario. It's a state that hasn't delivered development, but it's also a state that manages to persist. Persist in a state of, if you like, unstable equilibrium. It's not good enough, but it's there nevertheless. One of the major problems related to that, why the leadership is poor, the institutions are poor, is because of the fragmentation of the population itself. All of that energy, there's no channel to focus them. It's a country of very high ethnic and religious fragmentation. You only need to compare Nigeria to, say, Tanzania or Malaysia to get the point I'm making. In Tanzania, the ethnic groups are too fragmented to make an ethnic case, so they automatically form alliances. In Malaysia, the Bumiputra, the indigenous, are sufficient enough to seize control of the place and use it for themselves and for the common good. In Nigeria, none of the majorities can take control like that. Everybody lives in fear, including in fear of the minorities who now seem to be taking charge of the system. So we have a peculiar structural problem, prisoner's dilemma, which conditions the reflexes of many of our leaders. We have no Nkrumah, we have no Mandela. We have ethnic champions, and that's the way it's always been. And I think this is some of the problems, as I see it, connecting our present with our past, our colonial heritage, our ethnic fragmentation, and the quality of our leadership. These have been big, big problems, by and large. But nevertheless, as I said, it's a country that still manages to persist. And I think it's important to address that question as well, because you don't take that for granted. The DRC has not, and neither has Sudan. What is unique about Nigeria, despite all of its problems, is that no internal challenge is enough to overthrow the state, for the past 50 years at least. So the question, therefore, is how does a suboptimal state continue to maintain itself? And I think that's really where I want to quickly... the most obvious reasons people will tell you is oil, army, and a middle class. The oil is obvious, is the petrol dollars, the army to ensure a certain limited control. The middle class, the civil society, the media, some of the judges, these are all the things that stand between Nigeria and the kind of anarchy that we find in some other societies. But over and above that, I think, is the determination and the creativity and the vitality of people. at various levels in that society to make sense for themselves, for their families, for their communities. The unfortunate thing is that the state and the nation as a whole has not been able to capture all of that in a constructive way to lead it into something that would lead to the potential that we think Nigeria can have.
Can I pause you there? Because okay, that's the kind you. Of five yeah. minutes which mm. each person is allotted, and I think you've brought up in lyrical terms such extraordinary things. I mean, I think the land of unrealized dreams, how does a suboptimal state sustain itself, a government at war with its people, it's an amazing, slightly pessimistic mix after Father Matthew's reasonably hopeful status quo. Dele, why don't we move to you and see what you make of it?
Thank you. I read a book recently, Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. It was a story of the Mongols, and it got me thinking about empires. The Mongols also were dominant around the 1200s, 1100s, 1,000 years ago, around the same time as the arts that we've seen. And you think of Mongolia today, and you say, how can it be? Can this have been the same people who conquered Russia, conquered Germany, conquered the Middle East, and conquered so much of the modern world? It's the same question that must occur to all of us who have seen this exhibition, to say, can it be the same people? Can we make the connection with the Yoruba of today, or indeed Nigeria of today? There's something else that the Yoruba had in common with the Mongols. Every people's had their own theory of the origin of creation. As the Mongols believed that God was the sky, so the Yoruba believed that God was the sky, Olorun. The Yorubas also believed that the essence of man lay in the head, and that's why so many of the figures that we saw relate to the bust of the head. The wider belief that the Yoruba had was that Ife was where life started, that this is where Oduduwa led his people and settled in Ife, that he was Ogun, the pathfinder, because like the Mongols, we believed in a pantheon of lesser gods. Yes, we had the Almighty, but also we had a pantheon of gods. Ogun was the god of iron, the god of war, the pathfinder. And he was the one that charted the path to Ife, from which what became the Oyo Empire then evolved, right up to the borders of modern Accra. I have to confess that of all the members of the pantheon, perhaps Ogun was my favorite. It may have something to do with my name. But that was the story. And that was 1,000 years ago. And then came what can only be described as a phase of arrested development. Because the question must arise in one's mind. What happened? If this is where the Yoruba and the Nigeria were 1,000 years ago, what happened? Especially in the light of the modern history of Nigeria. Well, what happened, as I say, was a story of arrested development. We had the interruption of the slave trade. The Yoruba Empire was dismantled, largely as a direct consequence of that trade, as wars were sponsored and promoted between the component groups. And then came the attacks from the jihadist Fulani, and also from the coastal areas by the British forces. And that takes us then to Nigeria, because people often say, what was there is always a shock to young Nigerians to hear that Nigeria only started in 1900. And they say, well, what was there before? And I say, well, what was there before was the nations that make up Nigeria. They were there all the time. And part of the problem that Nigeria's experience is the failure to find a mode of relationship between the component ethnic groups that make up Nigeria that can harness the talents that we all have. I think it was Rafiu who said that we've been at war with each other. The state is at war with the citizens, the ethnic groups are suspicious and wary of each other. And we haven't created a space within which all of us can grow and find fulfillment. And until we do so, it would always be a story of unfulfilled potential. Because that's what you see in that artwork. Potential that is there and was there, which somehow has not been harnessed and channeled. And what has happened since? Well, we had the war in Biafra, where the East, the Igbos, and it was principally the Igbos sought to pull out of the Federation because they were fed up with the arrangement. They were unsuccessful. It was a tremendously bloody conflict. Has the peace reigned? I'm not sure it has. I think there's a grudging acceptance of the status quo at the minute. But the embers of nationalism are still very much alive. As also, we've had the modern diaspora as a result of the frustration that many experience in Nigeria, its failure to harness what people have to offer. That's why here in the British Museum, there are so many Nigerian faces I can see in this audience. This is part of it. But there is a positive as well. There's a positive in terms of what the diaspora can bring to take us forward. But we would not really start to motor. This idea of Nigeria being a superpower will always be an illusion. And I have to say, it was the intention when Nigeria was designed. It was actually a Sir Peter Smithers who was in charge of the original design of the Nigerian Federation. And the dream then, the vision then, was to create a powerful state that was rich in material and human resources, that would be a power player in the affairs of the region. That's how he explained it. But he said that tragically, in the retrospect of 40 years, that we probably have to come to accept that it was a grave mistake and that it would have been better to create smaller states. And he was speaking with the hindsight of the collapse of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. I heard it said that Nigeria is still standing. Yes, it is. But I think Nigerians want it to move. We want it to move, and we want it to move quickly. And it will begin to move when the leaders, the thinkers, can fashion a model for Nigeria of unity that is embracive of the component nationalities rather than at conflict with them. I sum it up by saying there are two forms of unity. You have the unity of the apple, which is homogeneous and solid. But you can also have the unity of the orange, which is whole as well and is united, but the segments are recognizable. And oranges grow in Nigeria. Apples do not.
A recent survey of academics, of physicians, of lawyers, of city titans revealed that in every top 10 cluster in each profession, you would find one, sometimes two, Nigerians in British public life. And of course, it is true of writers too, one of whom is here, Chika Unigwe. And you've got a much more optimistic take.
Yes.
Because the superpower is out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I am a lot more optimistic than, you know, my fellow Nigerians at the table, because I'm going to look at Nigeria as a superpower from a cultural point of view, which is something I'm very passionate about. But I'd like to start by telling a very short story, because I'm a writer, because I've got a captive audience, and because I like to tell stories. So you're forced to listen to me. So in 1910, when Leo Frobenius led the expedition to Ileife, and they excavated the brass head of the Olokun, who is the god of the ocean. Leo Frobenius was so astounded by the beauty of what he had just excavated that he stood. And he said something along the lines of, he couldn't believe. No, he looked around at the blacks there, the Africans, and he couldn't believe that such feeble-minded people were the custodians of this marvelous work of art. And because he couldn't believe that the head could be made by Africans, he believed he had stumbled onto the lost empire of Atlantis, and that this Olokun head was actually the head of the Greek god Poseidon. Don't know if I'm getting the name right. Anyway, and so this story of Ophrobius is very relevant to the exhibition for very obvious reasons. But it's also, it reminds me of a lot of things as well. I remember going for Mass in my village, Osumeni, a long time ago. And I come from a very Catholic home, so going for Mass was nothing odd. But what was special about this was that I came face to face for the first time with a pagan. So this woman had just converted to Christianity, and she was brought to the altar. She was 90, you know, on her way to death. And so she was brought to the altar, and the priest announced that she had given up her heathenish ways, and she had burnt her objects of ritual. And my reaction to that was some sort of visceral pain, not at her converting, but at the fact that she had burnt these things that are irreplaceable. And then in 2004, the Ogugu Okija, which is a shrine in Okija, was raided by policemen who burnt everything down as well. And the reasons for that is very, you know, very arguable. And then in 2005, there was this evangelist whose aliases include Battle Axe of God and High Tension Corner. And he boasted that he had converted the priest of a shrine in Uli, also in southeast Nigeria, and that he had got the priest not only to burn down the shrine, but also to destroy all the objects of his ritual. And so I also sort of felt the same visceral pain I felt those many years ago when this pagan woman burnt all her objects as well, because these things are irreplaceable. And what the new sort of evangelization, the American sort of Pentecostalism is doing, is that people are encouraged, you know, that once, you, I mean, it's a black and white thing. Once you convert, you can't keep any of the objects. And there are no more creators of these objects. And so, unfortunately, these things are not coming back. They are being lost forever. And then from there, we go on to the mismanagement of the oil revenue of the 70s. And then what came out of that was that, I mean, now Nigeria is top. People are living on less than a dollar a day in Nigeria. And when you have a sort of economic situation, every career decision is preceded by the question, does it bring in money, right? And so when you have a sort of situation, the sort of there's some cultural decline, and then there is also brain drain. I mean, you have you're graduating scientists who can't work in conducive environment, and so they moved, they're lured to the West, where they can work in much more, you know, convenient environment, and they have 24-hour power supply and all of that. But there is, I mean, I was in Lagos 2 weeks ago, and what I could feel on the streets of Lagos, the ordinary Nigerians, there's this sense of optimism, there is this resilience. I mean, we still believe that NTA is the biggest channel in the whole world, you know, and the Nigerian, ordinary Nigerian on the street believes that Nigeria is the giant of Africa. Even in the face of everything, in the face of a president that disappears for 52 days and then turns up dead, and, you know, and in the face of everything else, there is this that resilience. And that sort of resilience gives me a lot of hope. But there is also a huge cultural renaissance. There are Nigerians being, you know, taking center stage in world literature. You know, Chimamanda won the Orange Prize. Trisha Nwabwani won the Commonwealth Prize. And I think it's something that we can't underestimate that. And then you have Nigerian artists. I mean, there are pockets of brilliant artists who are also, you know, taking center stage as well. There's Inkashoni Barry, there's Victor Hikameno, there is Auditor who's been commissioned to do something for the White House. And then you have good publishing houses as well. 10 years ago, this wasn't there. And then you have Nollywood, you know, with all its flaws. There are some really brilliant directors, you know, who have found a popular outlet to put Nigeria on center stage. And then you have the Nigerian music industry as well, which is conquering the whole of Africa. And so, yes, I am very optimistic. And so when Dele says, no, Nigeria can't be a superpower, I say it can be, definitely, culturally. I just hope, you know, it comes while I'm still alive. But we are getting there.
Well, before we open it up, I want the people who have spoken to perhaps pick each other's arguments to pieces. And I also want to clarify a couple of things. I'm very taken by the very powerful message you two gave, which is that these constituent parts don't bind together as a unit. And Father Matthew, you are not only a northerner, but you're even a minority as well. So you bask in a kind of double whammy. Although this morning's meeting, when we were talking to each other, they disputed whether he was a proper minority. But nobody's really sort of talked extensively about the north-south divide. And I'm wondering, first of all, let's pick on the optimism. Mm-hmm. When people talk about Nigerian writers, when people talk about Nigerian musicians, as you did, do people at home talk about Yoruba writers, about Igbo musicians, or are they talking about something they identify quite simply as Nigerian, great, yeah, and out there?
In my opinion, I think culture, I mean, the writing, the music, and Nollywood, they've sort of transcended that, you know, ethnic segmentations more. Like, it's almost become a Nigerian identity. You know, so you have Nigerian films, you have Nigerian music. Nobody's thinking along the lines of, okay, he's a Yoruba singer. I mean,
the film directors are not favoring Yoruba actors or whatever?
No. I think what you just have, there's a sense, some sense of Nigerian identity in a way that you don't find in maybe some other sectors.
So if that's possible in popular culture, why are you so pessimistic that it cannot happen in civic society?
No, I'm not entirely pessimistic. I was only pointing out that we have problems, yeah, and we can only advance when we recognize our problems and analyze them properly. And that brings me to some of the things that Dele was. So I believe that Nigerian society, there are many things that hold people together, apart from just the economy, the oil, or the army. If anything else, the elite today cannot afford to wreck the boat. They stand to lose more than anybody else.
Have you recovered from colonialism?
In many respects, it's impossible to talk in the terms of recovery. You make of yourself what you want in the context of your background. Our background is still very much there in the way we operate. I agree with Chika that there's a Nigerian movie industry, but there's also an ethnic segmentation, and that's not necessarily bad. I think we are trying to get to grips with some of these things, and the people who are in charge are not helping matters. That's really the problem. I wanted to respond very quickly to some of what Dele said. I think when we talk of Nigeria's problems, we must talk of them in the context of our ability to change things. To list all our problems in a way that kind of demobilizes us or dispirits us, I don't think that would get us too far. And the once, if you are going to talk of change in Nigeria, you have to address the ethnic issue, you have to address the religious issue. And I believe that it's better done in a context in which, in fact, we emphasize the common things that hold us together, rather than your image of apples and oranges, everybody living in their own ethnic ghettos, as it were, or segmentation. I don't see the future of that country in those terms.
Would you be happier with a pomegranate?
In fact, I was thinking of bananas. More like, we also grow bananas.
Father Matthew, could you just talk to us quickly about religion? Because, the one thing a schoolboy learns, if he learns anything about Nigeria, is that the north is Muslim and the south is Christian. And we've talked about the ethnic groupings, but we haven't really talked about what part religion plays.
Well, thanks to the distorted nature of British historiography.
Educational systems.
No,
yes.
Historiography. Because, this is one of the problems. If you look at the way the British presented, we talked the same thing about Sudan. Predominantly Muslim in the north and predominantly used to be animist, now it's been baptized, we are locked in that time frame. The reality is that people's lives are more complicated than that. And a lot of the things, we're privileging ethnicity and religion, but this is purely at an elite level, at the level of the struggle for power and so on and so forth. So I think you've got to look at those identities at the level of their instrumentalization. From the point of view of how people live their lives, I come from, and most Nigerians will tell you basically the same kind of story. I come the reason why I say I'm not even a minority is that I actually qualified by saying I'm a minor minority. But I come from a background in which we never really talked about religion in that sense of the word. I lived with Muslims most of my life, and many people will agree that it's only when it comes to the inability of the political elite to frame the issues properly that people fall back on these identities. But, we must also be fair to Nigerian politicians with all their foibles. I think the political class has managed in a very, very complicated environment to negotiate alliances in such a way and manner that those of us who are probably just scholars don't really understand. And he makes the point about how is it that this dysfunctional country is still holding together? There must be a reason. Now, I believe that Nigeria, with all its difficulties, has a special and will have a special role to play. I also believe that where we are now, the return of our country to democracy offers us a wonderful opportunity. A lot of the conversation has been that somehow there is conflict between Christians and Muslims. The Western media didn't help in the way it presented the matter, because the real issues were, if you take any conflict at all in Nigeria and subsequently in Africa, that people now relate to Islam, to Muslims and Christians. The realities are different. And if I may just give you a simple practical example. My younger sister lived in a place, in a part of Kaduna that is, we may call, predominantly Muslim. And across the street from where she lived was a Muslim, an old man, who treated her like his own daughter. She would go to school and always leave. She would go off to work and, her daughter would come and collect the key from the old man. In 2000, when we had one of these crises, a group of young people, so-called Muslims, they came, and once the riot started, the old man sent his children to my sister's shed, and they cleared all her things into his home. And then he directed my sister and her daughter to the military barracks, which was just across the road. And then they came and burnt down her shop, but she didn't lose much. And then 3 days later, the so-called Christian youth organized a revenge attack. And they came and burnt the old man's house and burnt everything my sister lived and worked for. Now, I'm caught in it because I don't know how to explain it. Her property was destroyed by a group of Christian youth who were actually supposed to be taking a revenge on her behalf. The point I'm making is, I think we've been confusing the failure of the architecture of governance in Nigeria, the inability of those who govern us to really think a bit more clearly and creatively about how to manage diversity. For me, this is really the issue. I do not believe that at the level of ordinary people, that is what you may call a religious problem.
Well, are they not too busy filling their pockets? I mean, can I raise something which hasn't been mentioned at all? We've mentioned oil, we've mentioned the military, we've mentioned colonialism. There is a $23 million trade agreement on offer from China. Lots of pocket filling there.
Yes, the pockets will the pockets will
What's
be filled.
What's the origin of this pocket filling?
You see, the corruption is universal. It thrives when there's an enabling environment. A thief depends on anonymity in order to succeed in his trade and endeavor. And when you have a governance structure that is so large, in which there's no real ownership by the people, it makes it easy for people to take the attitude, whose money is it anyway? And the culture then becomes, it'll be my turn soon. There's no sense of the long term. Everybody's living for today. Nigeria needs, and the Nigerian people need, they need a vision. There was a vision, and it was a realistic vision. And I think we've moved away from that realism. We're in denial.
Whose vision was it?
It was the vision of the Sadowna of Sokoto, Ahmadu Bello. You see, he understood the reality, which I fear we're in denial of. There was a conversation that was supposed to have taken place. Sadowna of Sokoto was the premier of the northern region at independence, because then Nigeria operated on a tripod. In credit to the British, there was some recognition of the reality of diversity, that the Igbos were not the same as the Yoruba, and the Yoruba not the same as the Hausa. And the governance structure needs to give room for each group to express itself. When there's enough chairs around this table, you don't struggle for the one and only. It's like a children's game of musical chairs. As the chairs start reducing in numbers, the competition becomes more intense for the one seat that's left. It's how we manage diversity, and we fail to manage diversity. That is a problem. Sadowna Sokoto and Nnamdi Azikiwe, who was the president at independence, had a conversation. Nnamdi Azikiwe said to Sadowna, "Let us forget our differences." And Sadowna replied, "No, let us understand our differences. I am a northerner and a Muslim. You are an easterner and a Christian. It's only by understanding our differences that we can build unity. That is the unity of the orange. If we pretend we're an apple, we'll continue to be in conflict as we have been. We've been looking for a superman to manage Nigeria. Well, let's find an ordinary person who can run the place properly."
This morning, Father Matthew told me that he thought the next election in Nigeria would be the most important election of all time, that Nigeria would be absolutely at an unprecedented crossroads, and one way led to the status, perhaps, that Ife bequeathed, and the other to continuance of what's going on. Do you in any way chime with that observation?
I wish I could. I thought so the past two elections, and I was disappointed. Yeah.
But he says the last election was the worst election he's ever known.
Yeah, but nonetheless, we still thought that somehow we are going to promised everything under the sun. It didn't take place. We have very many fundamental problems that one single bullet is not going to deal with it. Every one of us, you have to pull in their own way. Your novels, whatever you... Every one of us. So one election is not going to solve our problem.
But why can't you turn that sentence round and say, we have so many opportunities. The difficulty is determining which one we should pursue.
No, I'm actually...
And nobody's answered my China question.
No, I'm emphasizing our opportunities, but not through our leaders, through ourselves. Yeah, that's the...
Would you say then that culture has prevailed in spite of politics and the leaders?
Yes, definitely. Culture is prevailing in spite of... I want to say something about the last elections, by the way. It's very interesting, and I think Father Cook also mentioned it this morning, that for all its flaws, the last elections gave us our very first university-educated president.
And see what happened.
He died.
He mysteriously appeared at an airport where the lights were turned off. Many people said the ambulance was empty and that he'd been dead for 3 weeks anyway.
That's not possible. No. You don't leave a Muslim unburied for 3 weeks.
That's why the ambulance was empty.
It's just not done.
I think that the challenges that have been posed beyond the joke, the challenges posed by the demise of Yar'Adua and the opportunities are quite enormous. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's quite a lot of excitement, understandably so, with the new president. First of all, it's an improvement on Yar'Adua because he's got a doctorate degree. Yeah. What all that means? But I think that on a more serious level, I did an article about 3 weeks ago in which I was making the point that it's very interesting that here is a man who has, within 5 years, been deputy governor, vice president, acting president, and president, all at the same time. And not a single vote has ever been cast for him. Nobody has voted. And in a country where the political environment is so convoluted that you require sacks and sacks and sacks of money just to win a local government election, good luck, Jonathan has never spent a penny to campaign for election. So, my reaction, and of course, he doesn't have a godfather. But so I say, as a priest, I say to myself, well, what is God saying to Nigeria? It may sound counterintuitive, but I think, in my view, there is something very, very special about that. One, it demolishes the argument that when you require resources to be able to govern Nigeria, in a very strange way, most of the people who have spent a good part of their life amassing wealth to be able to become presidents never managed to make it. But I think what I'm saying about this next election is a lot of people are excited and they're telling good luck Jonathan to go ahead and run in 2011. The People's Democratic Party, to which he belongs, says very clearly that, look, we have an agreement, a zoning arrangement, and with the PDP, the assumption is that when you win election, you are not expected to contemplate losing the next election, which is why the PDP is arguing, well, General Obasanjo was in power for two terms. And so it is our turn. We're going to be in power for two terms. So good luck, Jonathan. You just warm the chairs until 2011 when a northern president is going to, a presidential candidate from the north. And of course, that north does not include a Matthew. It has to be Alhaji. But when that happens, then we'll continue from where Yar'Adua left off. That is the mindset. I'm saying a lot of people are saying to good luck, Jonathan, run. Now, if good luck, Jonathan decides to run in 2011, it will have serious implications for how Nigeria functions or goes to the next level. And I say two things. One, if he successfully contests election, well, I know that the good thing that will come out of that is that it will, the PDP itself will implode. And that will be good for Nigeria because we've got 57 political parties, and my friend is here. He's a member of one of the new parties, the COA party. But none of them is really strong enough to contest any election. But if that were to happen, it will challenge the foundation of the existence of Nigeria as to whether the country will have the capacity to hold together. I believe that if we are successful in organizing elections in 2011, whichever way they go, it will be a major landmark for Nigeria if we successfully negotiate that path.
Well, now I want to throw it open to the audience, but I want to start with somebody who's made a very profound study of Nigeria. He's written a book which is coming out in September. His book is My Nigeria, Five Decades of Independence. Peter Cunliffe-Jones, are you here? Where are you? Yes. Could I ask you what you make of the discussion so far and whether you have any sort of observations you'd like to bring into the debate that perhaps we haven't aired, particularly given our real task, which is in some way to transform this interesting and intriguing and extremely confusing entity into a superpower?
Well, thank you. I wasn't quite expecting that. It's a fascinating discussion. I mean, it's a fascinating country that very few people can agree about, which I suppose makes it so interesting. I'm bringing out a book later this year. The point that I try to do in that is that the reason for that, I'm a journalist. I work for the AFP news agency, and I was I met Father Kuka more than a decade ago when I came at the end of military rule, which was a time of great hope. There was a tremendous sense. I mean, Nigerians seemed to me one of the most naturally hopeful people, and there was a great surge of hope in 1998, which then dissipated somewhat in the early years of the Obasanjo government, and lots of unrest and lots of trouble and so on in the country. I questioned why that was, partly for personal reasons. My grandfather had been in Nigeria for nearly 30 years, and he ended up as one of the people who negotiated independence. He was the chief secretary of the colony in 1955. He was very familiar with Obafemi Awolowo and so on in that role, and taking part in the negotiations of the constitution, which created the tripod and all of that. And you can argue about whether it led to the civil war or what have you. The key point that I kept on coming back to was why everybody talks about poor leadership. Chinua Achebe wrote in 1983 a marvelously brief pamphlet about the trouble with Nigeria, and people are still asking the question, which is somewhat the problem. But his answer was that the problem of Nigeria, the trouble with Nigeria, is poor leadership. The question is why the poor leadership, and what it is that allows the leaders to do what they do, and has allowed, since he wrote that book, the leaders to do what they do. And that's my question, is why the leaders have been allowed by a people who everybody recognizes are vibrant and talented and rich in culture, produce extraordinary works of art, as shown by this exhibition, as shown by Chika's books and many, many other books. Why there are people who you can have extraordinary political discussions and tremendously in-depth political discussions. Why that political structure? Is it the fragmentation, the orange, not the apple, and so on? But why that political... Why that people allow the leaders to do what they do?
Your spontaneous response to that question.
In a sense, to answer that question, I'd like to take on two things said here. The ethnic thing, why I think I don't go for the ethnic argument, it builds boundaries when there's necessarily none. My hometown, Ilorin, is made up of 8 different people from different ethnic origins. We've come together as one community now. How are you going to break that down into different bits? So we cannot see our future as captured within boxes we can't escape from. But having said that, we also have to respect the differences that there are between us now. And that's why I think Jonathan should not run. Why we have poor leadership is that we don't have any means of disciplining them, no institutions. And one of the few institutions we have today is the recognition that no part of the country should monopolize the leadership anymore. It should rotate. And that's what Jonathan is going to destroy. One of the few things we are kind of agreeing on things in bits and pieces. And if he runs, he's going to destroy that. And we cannot discipline our leaders because we have no instruments for telling them when they should be in office and when they should leave office. So when they are there, they do what they like.
Let's widen it out. Who would like to ask a question? Yes, let's take you, ma'am, here. Right here, microphone coming to you. Hi. If you'd like to say who you are.
I'm Dionne Walker. As an outsider, I'm not Nigerian. I'd like to raise the China point again, if only to juxtapose another superpower in the making, and also at the same time add America and as a superpower that's collapsing, some may say, and sort of point to those two countries as in terms of leadership, and ask the question: if the issue with Nigeria is about leadership, are there good leadership in the making in terms of whether that's someone from the diaspora going back who can really raise, you know, push Nigeria up in terms? And the other question is to Father, the issue of the church and whether, and where's the church in all of this in terms of creating some sense of selflessness, altruism, and really responsibility towards the people of Nigeria?
Well, Dele, let me come to you, because ironically, there is an example of somebody from the diaspora coming back. I mean, until a few weeks ago, one might have been able to boast about it. One of the heads of Goldman Sachs has gone back to run the central bank. And finance minister, even higher than that, yes. And the central banker is also a return from the diaspora. But then they underlined they'd only be there for a year. But seriously, can you answer the first part of her question, and then we'll come to you, Father Kuka.
Yes, I can. I mean, the diaspora ever in touch with what's going on over there. In fact, their access to information is perhaps greater than what they would have if they were on the ground. And one of the positive and promising things about the diaspora presence is this. Whereas in the past, Nigerian leaders came and they studied in the universities in Britain or America or Europe for 3 years, and before the ink on their degree certificate had dried, they were running back home to seize the opportunities that were being vacated. Now, by virtue of the events that have happened, we have a situation where people are here for significant periods, actually working in the settings and learning how things are done in reality, rather than just a theory. Before, it was the book knowledge that we had, and we're very good at passing exams, Nigerians. right? And you wonder, with all that theory that we've absorbed, why can't we translate it into practice? Well, part of the reason was that the practical knowledge did not come with it. But now they are, if you look at the hospitals here, for example, most of those who look like me that you'll find in the hospitals more likely to be in Nigeria than not. And that's across the board, not just medicine, it's law, and indeed even working with their hands on the underground or whatever. All the experience counts.
And so do you regard, for example, China, the new superpower, as in any sense a threat to the well-being of Nigeria?
No, I think it's we were a little bit too captive before, and our trading partners, which was Britain and America principally, almost became very complacent. I think anybody who has anything to sell in the market is always very welcome when they're more potential purchasers. It keeps the producer a bit more focused and dynamic, and it keeps those who are looking to buy the produce, whatever that may be, it avoids a situation where you have almost a captive market and a monopoly situation.
Okay, well, let me pause you there and bring in the church.
Well, I mean, if you talk in glowing terms about what kind of role the church should serve, I people like some of the voices of some of us are becoming faint, in part because the rise of Pentecostalism with its obsession with prosperity has created quite a lot of problems. So despite living in this dysfunctional environment, that gospel has become very attractive, mm-hmm. because everybody is dreaming and sleeping and dreaming of becoming a millionaire. And the problem with Pentecostal Christianity is that it denies the capacity of Christianity to actually interrogate the state. Largely because the assumption is that, you know, I, the pastor, I'm connected with God. This is why I'm as rich as I am. And the only way you can deal with your social condition is to be connected to me and repent. Now, repentance is all wonderful, you know, but my argument is that we cannot have people becoming millionaires in an environment that clearly nothing is being produced. So if you ask what the role of the church is, part of the problem with our role is that we are, as you can see with Archbishop Tutu, he doesn't make headlines again unless something happens. With the end of apartheid, we tend to, or the end of dictatorship, we all tend to go out of business. But I think how the church repositions itself to continue to interrogate, you know, the inheritance of, I mean, the inheritors of the new order, it's really a major challenge. But I always, my argument is to say, look, we need to be a little bit withdrawn. Let people release their energy. Let them be able to assert their rights. Let them colonize the streets and understand the fact that it is their business. And now they've gotten back their voices.
If I had a graph of tonight's discussion, it would start very high with Neil's description of the artifacts and our wallowing in the Ife culture. Then there's a sort of precipice in which you identified this question, what happened between then and 1900? And then we get up to where we are now, which is kind of bogged down in the now. And I'm wondering whether there's anybody here who wants to kind of lift us out of this thing. And yes, masses of Nigerian hands coming up, so let's go straight to you in the middle there. Yes, and then I'll come to you because it's such a ferociously high hand. Yes. So if there is another mic, take it to the ferociously high hand.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, go for it.
And my name is Tonye Cole, and I work for a Nigerian company called Sahara Energy, which is an international company. And I'll lift the argument up because, one, I have never believed that you should rely on the government for everything. You have to work yourself and work yourself out. We found that staying in Nigeria, although we're Nigerian and we have a background of Nigeria, that's the base, we found that we could do exceptionally well outside of Nigeria, export the tenacity that you find in Nigerians. I found that Nigerians are by far one of the most intelligent people, very hardworking. I'm serious. I'm a Nigerian. I'm very serious. Very tenacious, very dogged, sometimes misguided, But when we put our minds to conquering anything whatsoever, once we put our mind to it, we will conquer it. Now, I've been everywhere. I travel a lot. I find Nigerians everywhere, and I just have a feeling that we're like the Jews many years ago, sent all over the world to gain the experience we daily has talked about, and we'll come back to Nigeria. Today, we employ so many people coming back in diaspora. So many of them we employ today. They've taken the quality of the work that we do to higher and higher standards. You can't buy that experience. It's a lot of experience. Well, now,
that's a very interesting offering, and in a sense, you've answered the question. You would take the question mark off. It's just the superpower is outside Nigeria. The Nigerian superpower is abroad.
Exactly.
And is borderless.
Good.
And no, just one more small point, because then we must take some more.
Okay, no problem. One more small point. Now, the main difference now is bringing everybody back. I still believe that leadership is the issue. But we should stop arguing about how to do it and just go and do it. We have to start doing it. We're each doing our part, and we're going to make sure that the leadership in Nigeria becomes what it should be. And we're all playing a part. And I don't agree with the rotational thing. I think that's it's antique.
Thank you very much. And then if you could get the microphone to the woman with the high hand in the back there, we'll get her next. So let's hear.
Yeah, my name is Femi Lunge. I came in from Nigeria this morning. I'm one of the diaspora that went back to Nigeria 7 months ago, and I'm going back to Nigeria next
Welcome.
Week.
Welcome. What an absolute asset you are tonight.
One thing I found in the 7 months I've been back in Nigeria is sometimes the attitude with which we, the diaspora, go back to Nigeria with stops any plan we have from working. We go back with the attitude of, I've seen it in a developing country, so I'm coming to tell you. The people back home are waiting for you. You think you know. We'll show you we don't know. And so for me, I spent the last 7 months observing, understanding the lay of the land. And it probably is a message, too, that when we want to take all our knowledge from out here back home. Let's also observe how things are done there and make sure we can customize. Besides that, I'm speaking from the perspective of a young Nigerian who believes in my country. I see some changes that have happened in Nigeria in the last few years. And back to the point of culture, 10 years ago, when I was in the university in Nigeria, if you went into a party, 90% of the music you hear was from the United States, and then you hear Fela. Now, if you go into a nightclub in Nigeria, 95% of the music you hear is from Nigerian artists. And then when they play the 5% that are foreign, people go and sit down. And for me, I'm coming. I'll quickly run through it. I think we're starting to appreciate our things and ourselves more. I think that a bit more. But the last point, I think part of our challenge as a country is the amount of common positive history that we have since independence across tribes. It's not so much. I think if you ask Nigerians to reflect back on the last 50 years, those moments when we remember that we're all proud to be Nigerian, I can tell you some of them. It was the day Nigeria beat Brazil in Atlanta 96. It was the day we won under 17 Olympics. And we'll get some more, hopefully, next week. The point is, football at the moment is the only time when we drop everything that's ethnic and think Nigerian. And I think if you think to countries like the UK, all the monuments you have, all the statues you have, are celebrating things that make you proud to be British. And I think we as Nigerians need to start creating monuments to celebrate things that make us proud to be Nigerians after our independence. Thank you.
And then if you get a microphone to the high blue hand here, if you just keep your hand up, sir. Yeah.
Hi.
The microphone will come.
Hi. And I think that the talks have been really interesting in terms of understanding what's internally happening in Nigeria. But what I'd be really interested to know is about the lessons learned in terms of the ethnic minorities, the positivity within society, and how that can be extended without the region, on a West African platform, but also on a global platform. Because as far as I'm concerned, a superpower is someone that can influence the political stability of regions and areas, and actually influence the economic stability. So we've learned about the lessons of, you know, a country that has many ethnic groups, has, you know, a great financial capacity. How can that influence the region of West Africa, East Africa, North Africa, and maybe even drawing on some of the sentiments of Pan-Africanism? And how can that be extended? Because superpowers now, so we're talking like China, and, you know, we saw the interactions of the kingdoms of Ife on a level playing field. So how does Nigeria infuse that kind of equalism throughout Africa? And that's kind of the questions that I really feel that we should be asking going forward.
We'll park that for a reaction from the panel. I'll bring the panel in a minute. I just want to take a couple more from here. A bit of Nigerian machismo seized the microphone from the other chair. So we'll take the machismo and then the man whose turn it was. Yes.
Thank you very much, John. John asked two questions that I don't think the panel actually addressed. The first was, have we recovered from colonialism? The second was, what's the original, or who were the original pocket fillers? These two questions are related. What we tend to take, or what goes for conventional wisdom, is that colonialism is over. In my view, it's not. It has carried on through other means. And the original pocket fillers were the British. They came and built a system for plunder, and they stole from us. And some of the stuff they stole still stay here in the British Museum.
Though a remarkable amount, actually, if you look at the labels in the Ife exhibition, a remarkable amount comes from the National Museum in Lagos. So I must say that in defense of the British Museum.
So they built a system for plunder. And what we had from so-called independence was just replacing the guys at the front office with black faces. But the system carried on. So in effect, we've got a system built for plunder that has carried on. So Nigerians have taken the baton and taken it to the next level from what the British taught us. Until we change that system built for plunder, We're not going anywhere as a nation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd also point out the rather interesting fact, which I thought in the exhibition was fascinating, was that one of the absolute key heads was saved by a British bureaucrat who refused an export license from Nigeria in 1903 or something, or 1929, 1949, I don't know, sometime way back. But anyway, let me take you, sir. Yep, and then we'll take one more, and it'll be you, sir, and that's it. Yeah, if you get a microphone to the man in the nice brown jacket there. Yeah.
Well, thank you, John. I'll begin with Mr. Ogun saying that it's like an orange, not like an apple, because I could actually ruffle feathers. I'm Nigerian, and I could box the four of you there. You're Yoruba, you're Igbo. You're from the north, Farakuka, you're a minority. You from Ilori, you're not sure if you're Gambari or you're Yoruba. So, why am I saying this? There's an elephant in the room, and I'm saying this. I was born in Yoruba, and Yoruba people gave me my first drop of water. The Hausa man taught me and prepared me for WAEC. The Igbo man gave me a degree. I'm the son of a federal civil servant. So I've seen the three major tribes at work. And maybe if you push me hard enough, I'll tell you about each one of them. The elephant in the room here is, in 1970, a genocide was committed. In that country, at the end of that decade, for 3 years, we killed one tribe. And what has held us back? And I'm not Igbo. In fact, my brother, my younger brother, I'm a priest like Father Kuka. I'm a Roman Catholic priest. I work in South London. I'm from Mobudu, the tip that comes into Cameroon, at the bottom there near the sea. I'll tell you the honest thing there. That the Igbos were murdered and slaughtered. On account of the Vietnam War, the U.S. and other countries did not pay attention. The British and the then government got away with it. Now, what is holding us back is, look, we are Africans, and I'm a priest. Whether you like it or not, the blood of those people slaughtered for 3 or 4 years calls for justice. And to keep that injustice going and to keep that genocide hidden as a nation, we've had a boys' club running that country. If we're 50 years of independence, let's stop deceiving Europeans. Let us own up and look at ourselves and say, where did we get it wrong? We are the only nation at independence who handed power to the least qualified of the party leaders. I'm not a Yoruba man. I would have handed power to Abo. How many of you, look, if you've never been to Ife, go to the University of Ife that Awo did not build with a drop of oil. It is the best university. I think I had the privilege of going to Ife. I went to the biggest seminary in Enugu. That's where I got my degrees. The Ife University is said to be the most beautiful university in the entire African continent. That man built it without a drop of oil. Why were the British so scared of him that power was now handed over to him? So you can sit here and tell me about superpower and talk all of this. There's an injustice on the ground, blood crying for justice. Father Kuka, you're my colleague. You're my colleague. You were at the Truth Commission. At any time, did you ever, and I challenge you here publicly, you're my senior colleague. I read your articles. My father made me memorize the New Nigerian. My father went to primary school, never saw the light of secondary school. But I read your man behind the mask, your article, to tell you how long I followed you. Because my father would interview me each day. He comes back from work, yesterday's newspaper, he could go to any page. I read your articles. Did you ever challenge your passenger and say, look, could we actually do something like an apology? Apologize to the anger, the simmering anger in the nation. Look at the Igbos in the face and say to them, we're sorry what happened. You can sit here and talk, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm grateful to the guy who gave me the ticket. I'm afraid I didn't even know this was happening. So Michael Corrigan of Access Bank UK, thank you very much for giving me a ticket.
Thank you very much. So, Father,
I must close. John, just allow me, John. Allow me. Let me remind them. Since you say you're telling them this, let them hear it. At the end of the day, John, the biggest problem we have, and let us stop deceiving people, our biggest problem there is not. You're talking that there should be no rotational president, there should be rotational presidency. The North can give us best candidates. How come it that the North has not given us their best men? The West has not given us their best men. The Igbos have not given us the... How come it that the best Nigerian minds, like the four of you sitting there from Father Kuka, any day Kuka stands election, I will vote for him. So at the end of the day, where are our best materials, men and women? Where are they? So the problems, all this Oyibo, English, or just John, Oyibo is another word for English.
Father. Where's the church and what time are the services?
I'm happy my brother has done me proud.
I did say, I must let you come in now. Follow that, as they say.
Thank you very much. My name is Dayo Fadino, and I work in London. I've been in England for the last 23 years. I grew up in Nigeria, did my primary, secondary, and A-levels in Nigeria before coming down to London. One problem I think we have as a nation, Nigeria, is we've all, in my opinion, we've always deluded ourselves as a great nation. We should stop using that word great because we are not. We are not great because you have people all over the country living in abject poverty. You have our health system that's gone to the, you know, to the dust. You have our education system that is not working. We have so much money that we could actually use to invest and to actually make the country better. We've not. So we should at least for the first time stop calling ourselves great. We are not great at all. Another thing I would also want to mention.
I'm going to have to pause you on the second one. I'm sorry about it, but it's just that we're incredibly running out of time because, of course, the whole audience got completely mad. I'm going to have to just... I'm really sorry, but thank you for your first point because actually what you've really done is to add to his elephant a great elephant in the room, and part of it is the great and part of it is the elephant. And seeing as a lot of this was targeted at your writings, respond.
Okay, thank you very much, John. I also was born in Nigeria, and I have some of that spirit. If you don't mind, I'll bring it into play.
Go for it.
I want to respond to three things. You asked the question about China, and it was asked again. I didn't want to comment on China. My son told me, get an autograph from Jon Snow. If you don't come back. So I didn't want to offend you, but quite frankly, China is the least of our problems in terms of corruption. Britain, the US, Germany, China, Switzerland. You give China the next 10 years, they won't do half of what those countries have done to us. So I do recognize the concern, but I think it's not entirely within the scale of what we have to deal with. I hope I do get my autograph, nevertheless. So that's about China. West Africa, despite Nigeria's problems, Nigeria is still helping her neighbors. There can't be peace in West Africa without Nigeria. As we speak, thousands of Nigerians from the north are fleeing hunger. They go to Nigeria, they get food, they get housed, not in a five-star circumstance, but no Red Cross goes there with any foreign food. And when the emergency is over in their country, they go back. That country has always been that cushion.
That describes a great country.
For that region. And I think we should not lose sight of that. Finally, the priest who said Igbos were killed. I was born in Igbo land. I'm not Igbo. I know what I am. As we say, where I come from, when the market closes, everybody knows his father's house. Now, I was born in Igbo land. I'm third generation in Igbo country. My family lost everything. We are not Igbo. We suffer. So many people have suffered. Raking over wounds from a priest is not going to get us far. And I pray that we abandon that path. We have to be positive. I'm done.
Father.
Well, you know, I again go back to the fact that Nigeria is 50 this year. I consider those to be substantially years eaten by the locusts. But I think on a more positive note, there is a lot for us to be hopeful for.
Is there a need for truth and reconciliation?
We've had one, and I served on it. And this is not the place to talk about it. I think a lot of the things Father has said, emotionally, they make a lot of sense, which is fine. But I think practically, the issues are more complicated than that. We are a truth commission. We can talk about it. There's a lot to be said about that. The whole Igbo question has been debated. And I think it also needs to be a bit fair to Nigeria. The war ended 1970. By 1979, an Igbo man was vice president of Nigeria. Mm. It's a pity that we've not even touched on the distortions created by the military, but let's not go there. Mm. Let me conclude by saying my slight disagreement with Chinua Achebe is this whole emphasis on leadership, and I think Ralph touched on the issue. I say we confuse office holders with leaders. I mean, you can be a leader without being in office. I mean, the very notion that Nigerians think that if you, somebody with no name, no address, and we live in a country in which a man just wakes up one day and he can call off his mistress and make her a minister, he can call off his in-law and make him a minister, no problem. I don't think that necessarily makes you a leader. And so the idea that somehow we are just waiting for people, most of who have gotten into where they are by all kinds of negotiation, whether they come from diaspora or whatever the case may be, accessing power in Nigeria has its own law, its own logic. And you have to pay the dues. So I just make the point that to reinforce what Ralph is saying, I think if we understand the fact that we can exercise power without necessarily being in office, and that we are all leaders in various capacity, I mean, in our own various departments, whether you are a student in the university or whether you are just a student in a secondary school or whether you are a church leader, all of us have our own responsibilities. The great thing about Nigeria is that we're all angry at the same time, we're all angry about the same issues, and somehow people believe that if you're not angry at the same tempo, something must be wrong with you. And, you know, so the conclusion, it's a very serious thing because I get a lot of flack because people think, why are you no longer angry? And Nigerians think, if you're not angry, somebody must have paid you money. So I believe that we're not where we really ought to be. But I don't think we are too far away from that. The greatest thing about this country is, like a man said, who is actually a Muslim, he said, Nigeria is like a Catholic marriage. It may not be happy, but it doesn't break up.
Thank you. The point Fala Kuka made about Nigeria being a country where a man can just wake up and call his mistress and make him make her a minister sounds very much like Berlusconi. So it's not particularly a Nigerian problem. But I do think that we haven't really... I think there's some sort of hesitancy in Nigeria to properly interrogate the fragmentation of Nigeria, which was exacerbated by the 66 coup, and which is sort of filtered down, you know, up until now, when an Igbo man can't be president. There's a certain hesitancy to interrogate that.
You want it in the news, John?
And I think that is something that has got to be addressed.
That was the authorities telling me it's time up. But
I want to respond to a few points. I'm not sure whether you're Yoruba or Igbo any longer. Earlier on, he was claiming to be Yoruba.
Now I hear. The market is over. We all know where to head.
Now I hear he's Igbo. You see, the thing about the Yoruba that they had in common with the Mongols again is that we were very accommodating.
Everybody says that in Nigeria.
The Mongols were very accommodating to all faiths. So we have a situation where I am Yoruba, my wife who's over there is Igbo from Enugu like you, and my first cousin is Muslim. We haven't got a problem at the social level. We haven't got a problem at the level of music and literature. That is not the challenge. The challenge is at the power level, because power is harder to divide. And we'd like to think that Nigeria's problem is unique. It isn't. All people of this world have these challenges of identity. We have this Scottish Parliament here in Britain. We have the Welsh Assembly. Recognizing diversity is not a bad thing. And the choice is not between Nigeria as we have it or no Nigeria. There's Nigeria of the orange. Coming back to the author who asked the question, why the poor leadership, and why have the people allowed the leaders that we've had to do what they do? The answer, I think, is this. When a tree consistently produces bad fruit, you have to start looking at the roots of the problem. to keep just removing the bad fruit, cut it down, somebody said. there is an alternative, I say. The alternative is rethink the blueprint, rethink the structure that will allow Yoruba, Igbo, Ijo, Tiv, all of them, to really bring what they have to offer to the table, such that, as somebody said earlier, we get the first 11 of each of these ethnic groups. Then we can be a superpower. Only when we're producing the first 11. Right now, we are producing, I don't know if it's the third 11, we are producing something way down. The second point is, why have they got away with it? They've got away with it because it's not democracy that we're practicing. You can have the trappings of democracy. You can have elections. But is that democracy? Democracy is supposed to be bottom-up. The revenue also should be bottom-up. What Nigeria has is top-down, and the revenue is top-down as well. And because the revenue is top-down, the people do not have the means to hold people to account. I'll give it a very simple illustration. In my village, if you collect money together, the families, and you appoint somebody, in fact, the process of choosing who should be the custodian of that money, somebody may stand up and say, I will take charge of the money. Everybody knows everybody. You need knowledge in order to assess qualities. Knowledge of the individual. And they say, you can't possibly hold the money. Your grandfather was a thief. Your father was a thief. And in all probability, you're a thief too. It's because there's that knowledge of the qualities of the individual. Similarly, when the money is stolen, the prison is not a cell, it is an open prison. That is what makes governance possible. Theft is possible because these leaders, who knows Good Luck Jonathan? Who knew Yaradua? Have we recovered from colonialism? Short answer is that we haven't. What I point to is that until Nigeria is serving its people and not simply serving the international community. Yes, we do these things abroad. We show charity to our neighbors. We peacekeep abroad and make war on our people. And yes, we did have a truth commission, but the truth was not told. The truth was not faced. Facing the truth is part of the process of healing and putting our hands up to the Igbos and say, we did wrong. You were not completely without blame. However, the wrong was done. And it's only through that process of looking each other in the eye and telling the truth for once is the truth that will set us free, and it was the truth that will enable us to become a superpower.
Jenny, thank you very much. Well, I'm sorry, there's still an absolute forest of hands. I mean, I know we could go on till midnight without any difficulty at all. This has been certainly one of the most exciting roller coaster debates I think we've had. We've had 10 linked to exhibitions held here, and this has been a thrilling examination of a most extraordinary country. I mean, we have an admission that the UK system of governance that was bequeathed to Nigeria is probably an agent of much of what is wrong. Yet it has spawned a country which boasts its best leaders are not in office. It's a superpower who is not at home. It is therefore, in a sense, a true descendant of Ife, a thing of extraordinary quality, a thing of extraordinary infection across many, many other countries and continents, and through many strands of many different cultures. It is a superpower, but not as we know it. It isn't a superpower at home, but damn me, it seems to be abroad. On your behalf, I would like to thank four of the most beautiful discoursants, if that be a word, that I've certainly ever had the pleasure of chairing. And above all, I'd really like to thank you for being the most energized, engaged, and exciting audience we've had here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.